ride to school on my bicycle, and I used to have this biting cold against my fingers, and I would get to class, and it would take me 5 minutes or so for my fingers to thaw so I could take notes in class because it was that cold. And not being very smart, it never occurred to me to get gloves. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, just drive it, bike to school in the morning. And that continued for some while, and one of the things that happened was that I had a lot of aversion to this biting cold. It was very painful. And I'd have a lot of self-pity of, poor me, why did I choose to go to school in Davis? I could have gone to University of Hawaii or someplace else. Or maybe I could have had a car, or, you know, why am I doing this? And then one day, I had the memory that, I remembered that the sensations in my finger, the biting cold, was exactly the same, as far as I can remember, exactly the same sensation I used to have when I was a teenager, and I'd go skiing in the mountains. And there, the association with the biting cold was one of real thrill and joy and delight. The associations we make, it might be where we live. So riding the bicycle, I was living in the associations of self-pity and all that. Up in the mountains skiing, I was living in, with the associations of delight. You know, what a wonderful thing to be skiing down the mountains. The physical sensation in both situations was an unpleasant situation. But my evaluation of the context and my judgment of the situation had a lot to do with what I did with that experience. Certain foods or drinks, like beer, is, some say, people say it's an acquired taste, because in and of itself it's awful. But you get used to it, you know, pretty quickly, and after a while it gets to be nice, and you get to kind of serve different flavors of beer. But, you know, give beer to a, you know, most 10-year-old and they'll spit it out. So there's a lot of complicated layers of relationships that we have to our experience. But the teaching on Vedana is that underneath the complicated layers, the experience itself, in its rawness, is very simple. Every experience is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. One of the things that we're then instructed to do in mindfulness practice is to begin noticing whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So was that pleasant? I think that for me it was kind of, I don't know if it was pleasant or, yeah, I can see you better. And the reason for doing that is that, and the reason why this is so profound is that a phenomenal number of our reactions to life is built on how we relate to whether the experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. If the experience is pleasant in a very simple way, there's often a movement towards it of wanting and grasping onto something. If the experience is unpleasant, there's often a reaction of pulling away or striking it away or pushing it away. So we're sitting in meditation, with our eyes closed, and say that we've eaten a little bit too much for dinner, and you're trying to stay with your breath. And because you feel your breath maybe in your, you know, down low down in your belly, it's kind of, you feel this unpleasant sensations of your full stomach as you meditate. So there can be no reaction to that, just awareness of unpleasantness that's there. Or there can be all kinds of judgments. Oh, what a fool I was to have eaten before I came to meditation. I should have known better, have a big meal. Or I'm failing at meditation because meditation is supposed to be all about joy and bliss, and now I have this unpleasant experience. And so then there can be kind of an aversion to the unpleasantness. Oh, I don't like this. I think I chose the wrong day to come meditate. I'm leaving before they notice, before anybody opens their eyes. I'm out of here so that I can come back another day and try again. Because this is not, I don't want to hang out with something unpleasant. I came here because I thought it'd be really pleasant to meditate. My day's been unpleasant enough. I mean, I'm here for pleasure. And so it's not pleasant, so I'm out of here. I'll come back another day when things are pleasant. Or there's is a pleasant sensation in the body, and say you're sitting in meditation, and suddenly there's, you know, upwelling feelings of delight and wholeness and warmth that kind of tingles up through the cheeks and maybe around the chest, and it's very pleasant. And then that darn meditation teacher up there rings the bell to end the sitting. I mean, and then suddenly there's all this judgment. They have the sittings on Thursdays are too short. How could he do it that way? And so suddenly there's all these reactions to that. Kind of, we wanted more of the same thing. So I don't know if these are the best examples by any means, but the idea is that based on whether things are pleasant or unpleasant, we either recoil to things or go towards it, hold on or push away. And that's often masked, that we're reacting that way, by the fact that our reactions often get complicated. Sometimes, say you walk down the street to Palo Alto and you see someone who looks very unpleasant. Maybe they're a homeless person. And you're uncomfortable with that situation. Who knows exactly why the discomfort is there, but an experience of discomfort. Your reaction is one of recoiling from the discomfort. But then you need to justify the recoiling. And so then we build a whole philosophy, maybe even a whole politics, the party we join, political party we join, everything. Not based on the great philosophy of the party or the great philosophy of whatever, but rather that philosophy supports the aversion. Let's get rid of it. Let's get away from it. And I've known people who are experts at this, who, based on what they want and what they don't want, their logic follows. And the fact that suddenly the situation changed and their desires change, and they're great, like lawyers, they can kind of, they're phenomenally creative in twisting any discussion around so it seems like what they want is absolutely the right thing. That's, you know, that's the way the universe was built. It should be that way. And what they don't see is that they're actually building their understanding, their philosophy, whatever the logic, on preference. And sometimes the preference begins in something so raw and amoeba-like as our pulling away from something unpleasant and going towards the pleasant. Is that simple? Is that kind of simplistic? Sometimes a huge edifice of how we tend to relate to the world. So in meditation is one place where we can start deconstructing all the complicated way in which we relate to the world and interpret it and see it, and kind of get back to the amoeba cellular-like level of our experience to see in what is happening in our experience in the very directness of the moment. How is that experience? What is that? And then how are we reacting based on that? Can we see that moment where the experience is pleasant, and then the motivation arises within us to hold on to that, to want that? Or can we see that moment in the experience where it's unpleasant, and the contraction begins, or the pushing away, or the judgment, or the aversion, and the whole slew of possibilities that might arise? It can get very complicated very quickly, the relationship we have, but it all begins at a very simple juncture, very simple beginning. Particular kind of a reaction to pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. If we can see that point of contact, that initial point of contact, before the elaborations begin, there's a great opportunity to leave a situation alone and not get caught up in the relationship that we have, whether it's a relationship of aversion or desire or all the variations of that. And to see that is a place that some people can find or feel, see, a tremendous amount of freedom. Oh, I can I don't have to get involved. I can be free. Freedom in Buddhism doesn't necessarily mean freedom to do whatever you want, but rather it means freedom from having to do anything at all, or having to react any particular way. Freedom from having the mind contract, or the heart contract. Freedom from compulsion, acting on some kind of automatic pilot. Freedom from reactivity to the situation. So if we can see this very simple place, oh, that's unpleasant, and then the moment later see how there's a pushing that away, a react compulsion, automatic kind of pushing it away, then you might also see that the two are actually separate from each other, and you can maybe just leave the situation alone, let go of the reaction before it builds into something more complicated. And then you might ask, you know, why do that? Maybe you can understand why. Maybe you can understand that maybe it's okay to do that with things that are pleasant. But it seems like the most natural thing in the world to have some aversion to things which are unpleasant and want them to go away. Part of the reason is that as long as we're acting on compulsion, automatic pilot kind of reactions, we're not really free. And even though the automatic pilot might have to do with pleasure, we're just as much enslaved to that as our reactivity towards that which is uncomfortable. So if we really want to discover a form of happiness which is not connected to what is pleasant or unpleasant, or which is larger or encompasses both, if we want to discover a kind of happiness and peace, sense of well-being, that's large enough that it can exist even when situations are pleasant, or even when situations are unpleasant, then we have to learn how to not get caught anymore by the reactive relationship we have with things being pleasant and unpleasant as they arise. So every experience has this quality, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. How do we relate to it? So sitting in meditation, the breath is tight and constricted. It's an unpleasant experience. How do you relate to that? It's possible, in a sense, to have no relationship at all. Just there it is. Oh, the breath is tight and constricted. And so it just goes on the way it is, and no reactivity, no compulsion, no tightness in the mind at all. The breath is deep and relaxed and smooth, and you know, you feel like you're just gliding on your, you know, sailing, gliding your way to enlightenment. Mm-hmm. You know, and you feel, you know, so then there's a desire for that, or judgments of self-pride, and you know, I hope everyone's noticing how I'm breathing, there's all this activity that happens as a result to somehow latching onto that. When it's pleasant or unpleasant, there's a happiness that can exist that is larger, that encompasses both, but which is not tied to things being pleasant or unpleasant. Now this is a very powerful lesson for some people, because a lot of people will confuse happiness with pleasure. And a lot of people will have this idea that their life is not right unless it has a certain quota of pleasure as part of it. That discomfort is a sign of personal failure. Discomfort is a sign that the universe hasn't come together in the way it's supposed to, if everything is right. Discomfort is a sign that there's all these interpretations of what it means that things are uncomfortable. It doesn't have to mean anything. It just means we're uncomfortable. We don't have to add a whole philosophy around it. Life has a fair amount of discomfort built into it. One of the exercises that, first Vipassana kind of exercise that I encountered in Thailand, which I've heard many times in Southeast Asia, is go place yourself in the most comfortable, easy chair you can find. Make yourself really comfortable, get all the pillows you need, and just prop yourself up really nice, and don't move. And see how long you can stay there before you get uncomfortable. And what you'll find is very quickly you'll get uncomfortable. And what you might notice is that, in kind of extending the lesson, is that we're constantly getting uncomfortable in our daily life. Constantly happening. It doesn't go more than a few seconds, probably, with some little discomfort. And then we move our legs. You know, or we kind of adjust our posture, or, you know, all kinds of kind of movements that we do, because we're constantly kind of going after getting away from a little bit of discomfort and trying to get a little more comfortable again. There's a constant negotiation of this issue of pleasure and comfort and getting away from discomfort. It can be quite innocent and quite, you know, it's fine to do it in and of itself. But in meditation, at least, it's a place we're trying to train ourselves not to act on these automatic kind of almost thoughtless, almost kind of unconscious little movements and reactions, but rather to discover a different capacity we have, which is the capacity for the mind or the heart to dwell independent of things being either pleasant or unpleasant. And this is a very, very useful lesson to have in life. I found myself in many situations where are not my making, where it was phenomenally unpleasant. And in years past, I would have just done the best I could to get out of there. But it was actually very helpful if I could hang in there. Someone was quite distressed. Someone's in great suffering, and it's very uncomfortable. It's very unpleasant to be with someone who's in great distress sometimes, and where there's kind of tragedies left and right. But the basic idea is I'm uncomfortable in the situation. There's a discomfort experience. And then because I've learned to some degree that I don't have to tie my personal sense of well-being, my happiness, to pleasure or discomfort, I can enter into that situation willingly, and I can watch my reactivity to that and let my reactivity drop away. So I can enter into situations which are uncomfortable, where I need to be, and not get tense and stressed because of it. It's a very useful thing. Same thing with experiences of pleasure. You have experiences of pleasure, and I can allow it to be there without wanting it to be any different. Meaning, not needing it to be to stay, not needing to hold on to it, not needing to defend it and preserve it. Or sometimes when it's quite pleasurable, not being afraid of it. Some people are afraid of pleasure. I can just let the pleasure be there. Just without any extra stuff going on. And what it allows us to do as it goes along here is that our relationship to our life experiences can begin shifting from being one of reactive responses to wise responses. The ability not to have to react to the situation. To discover that place of balance, some people call it the zero point, where you can be present for something and there's no movement towards it and no movement away from it. It's okay, in a sense, for it to be as it is. There's no compulsion towards the judgment or aversion or holding or anything. It's okay for it to be there. And the spaciousness of the mind is just okay, the way it is. And from that, then there can be opportunity for wisdom to discern how we need to respond. So rather than reacting, the idea is to respond. What's the wise response in the situation? If we're not going to react on automatic pilot, but rather give a chance for some deeper knowing and understanding and looking at the situation to occur, it really helps to have that ability of being at zero. If we don't have the ability to rest at zero, then the danger is that our biases and preferences will color the way we see the situation. And then the so-called response that we have, the way we act on the situation, might not be a wise one, but rather is twisted by our biases, by our preferences. When I was meditating in Burma, I came in one day to my meditation teacher's room for interview, and he had an altar just inside the door, and there were some Buddhas there. And I don't remember now exactly. I think maybe every time I entered, maybe I looked at it or bowed to it or something. But anyway, this day I came in and I glanced to the altar there, and there was a new Buddha on the altar. And but I was very mindful. I was watching what was going on inside of me. And what I saw was, I turned towards the altar. I saw there was something new there. I saw that it was a new Buddha. I felt that it was a pleasant experience to see this Buddha. It was a beautiful Buddha. I felt it was a pleasant experience. I felt the pleasure of looking at this beautiful Buddha. And the heels of that immediately came the desire to have that Buddha. And the heels of that came, how can I plan? How can I scheme to get it? Can I buy it from someone? Can I talk someone out of it? Can I sneak in here when no one's looking? You know, how can I get that Buddha? And what was so remarkable for me in that experience was to see how those steps happened so quickly. Because normally in the past, I would have just been lost in the scheming, and it happened so quickly. But I could see that that actually was built on a very simple desire for movement towards more pleasure. It wasn't even for a Buddha. It was simply, I wanted more of that pleasure of being able to look at that kind of beautiful artwork. And it happened very, very quickly. But I saw it there, see all those steps, and because I could see all those steps kind of all at once, kind of shoo, I was also able to just let go of it all, come back to zero. And that was great. So, and then later someone gave me the Buddha. It was actually, they bought it for me. And they put it there on the altar so the teacher could bless it before it was given to me. I didn't know any of that. And that's the one that's on the in the cover of the Voice of Spirit Rock. It's like that one, yeah. But it's a different, same kind of one. Some of us have a common pattern of ways in which we relate to something as simple as the pleasant and the unpleasant. And to begin discerning what our common pattern, our common reactive pattern might be, is very helpful, because then you're more likely to catch it when it happens. If you're a desire type, then you might notice those reactions of desire, the wanting, that arise based on things being pleasant. If you're the aversive type, you might notice much more the strong tendency towards having aversion to things which are unpleasant. Pleasant and unpleasantness abounds in our experience. There's no shortage of it. Some people pick up, they have like antennas, and they tend to pick up more one than the other. So it isn't that the way we experience the world is kind of a neutrally unbiased way. The experience is pleasant and unpleasant in and of itself. We don't construct the pleasantness and unpleasantness. But some people kind of have their radars out just for the pleasantness. Some people just the unpleasantness. And so then they build their universe and their philosophy based on that. It's said that neutral experiences are quite uncommon. Experiences which are neither pleasant or unpleasant are not very usual to have. Even though, what that means is that we might think there's a whole wide range of experiences which are neither pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. It means that we're not being very sensitive to actually how it is. And if we pay more attention, we can see it's just really subtle how it is. But when things are neither pleasant or unpleasant, it's said that it lends itself to confusion sometimes. Confusion, not knowing how to relate to it. Sometimes it lends itself to boredom. Sometimes it lends itself to sometimes it can lend itself to aversion because of the attachment to pleasure that we have. So sitting in meditation is not supposed to be simply kind of finding a way to get calmer and calmer, more and more blissed out, more and more peaceful. But rather, it's supposed to be an opportunity to begin seeing the patterns of what makes our life, the operating principles of our life, what makes us tick. So that we can translate that, bring that with us into our regular life, everywhere else we go. So if we can see in the laboratory of meditation, see very carefully how we relate to pleasant and unpleasant, see the pleasant and unpleasant of situations and how we relate to it, then in that learning area of meditation, we can learn something which is directly translatable to the rest of our life. It can give us a lot of freedom, a lot of space, a lot of ease in the rest of life, so we're not caught on automatic pilot on whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Sometimes mindfulness practitioners will take a period of meditation and only focus for a while on whether whatever experience they're having is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. They're just kind of, oh, that was pleasant. That was unpleasant. That was pleasant. That was unpleasant. Just kind of just noticing how it is as a way of kind of exploring this realm. So those are my thoughts for today. This category of the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is one of the very, as I said in the beginning, one of the very important ones in the practice of mindfulness meditation. It's probably not taught in the Western Vipassana circles as much that often, or that much as maybe as it could or should, partly because it lends itself to being a little bit too analytical and thoughtful about experience. Was that pleasant? Was it unpleasant? You know, what is pleasant? What is unpleasant? And people kind of get lost in the world of analysis and figuring out, and people become thoughtful about their experience rather than just feeling it. So on retreats, for example, sometimes the instructions of mindfulness is given systematically over many days. And sometimes it isn't until into the sixth or seventh or eighth or ninth day of a retreat or longer before someone might give the instructions on the pleasant and unpleasantness. Because it helps if the mind is quite stable and still, and you don't have a tendency to get lost in the proliferation of thoughts. You start looking at the simple experience. Anyway, so there's my thoughts about the topic. So now it's your turn to ask questions or comment about that, or ask about anything you want, actually.
Don't we still have a responsibility to care for that body, even if we know that it's just an unpleasant feeling? Say, okay, the body's just tired, whatever. So, the body's tired, or it's unpleasant. I don't know. Maybe it's just I'm not using common sense or something. But I guess maybe I just haven't integrated.
Well, that's what I was trying to point to, is we do have an ability to respond, which is, you know, turning responsibility upside down, the word. But the question is, how do we respond? How do we use that responsibility? What is the way in which we respond to responsibility? And seeing clearly what's going on is very helpful to do that. This instruction is not supposed to be done, you know, you're supposed to stand there kind of, you know, and face up to everything kind of blankly or neutrally and accept everything as it is. But you need to take care of your body. Mm-hmm. But aren't there probably you find lots of examples where it's either a pleasant or unpleasant situation that doesn't require doing anything about it. Having eaten too much before you come to meditation and your belly is, you know, your breath is a little bit constricted and difficult because of it, mm-hmm. It doesn't require you to run out immediately and vomit, or, you know, it doesn't require you to go, you know, immediately, you have to go lay down or go for a run or, right. You know, take care of yourself. Maybe what you need to do then is just register that as a fact and say, okay, next time I'm not going to eat as much. Yeah. And resolve, okay, next time I'm not going to eat as much. And for now, I'm going to try to be present for this without there being reactivity to what's happening. Mm-hmm. Just let it be there as it is by itself. Mm-hmm. And that's and train myself. So part of meditation is a training to learn how to be with things in this balanced way, that it goes forward or away from anything, just allowing things to be as they are. So at least in meditation, you find your meditation, your daily meditation at a time when you don't have to respond to anything, you don't have to do anything, where you increase the chances that nothing needs to be acted on. Mm-hmm. So, or part of your commitment, this is a time in my life where I'm not going to act on anything. If I get a headache, if I get, a full stomach, if I get tired, if I'm tired during meditation, right. This is a time, for this 45 minutes, where I'm going to practice just being there for that and seeing how I react to it and seeing, can I find that place of neutrality which doesn't push or pull towards it. And then when the 45 minutes is over, then you can discern, well, I'm tired. This really must mean that I need a nap.
Right.
But at least for that time. And the quest is to try to find that ability to be at the zero point. And to have a visceral sense of what zero is like becomes very helpful as we go along in our life to highlight for us the ways in which we're not at zero.
Right.
See, most people are not at zero ever.
Right.
And so they have no idea what zero looks like. And so they don't even know that they're not at zero because they think zero means, you know, whatever, running around like crazy. But if you really get a sense of zero in meditation, really deeply, just knowing how to allow things to be as they are, then that you can carry that with you as kind of as a memory that gives you a really powerful reference point as you go about your life to help you show you very clearly the reactivity that's operating.
I guess recently I've kind of misused that in life. I mean, my brain was kind of fried and I, you know, was just like, okay, I'm just going to be with this. I'm just going to be, you know, present for this exhausted body, you know. It's just exhausted. I'll just be present for it. And I was working at the time and, you know, I'll just be present for it, you know. But I was kind of contracted around the fact that I had to be, I was contracted or attached to doing what I was doing. I was like, I have to do this. I have to be present to this. And I was contracted around that. I mean, I didn't have spaciousness, and I kind of misused. Anyway.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, that people will, feel a sense of obligation or duty to be, even in spiritual practice, to kind of, okay, I'm supposed to be a certain way, and then discount or ignore, what's really necessary to do or the wise thing to do. And maybe doing the work you had to do was a fine thing to do, but what your mindfulness needed to have done was to turn around and show how you were contracted about doing it, and how your idea, I need to be here for this, was blinding you from the fact that you're already suffering. But if you expanded your mindfulness, you really see how you're suffering that situation. Because you weren't at zero, you were suffering about it. But you weren't allowing yourself to see that suffering.
Yeah.
And enough, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
If you saw suffering more clearly, maybe then you'd have the wisdom to know how to respond, how to act. Maybe you see what you can let go of, maybe, the contraction that you had, the judgments you had. Or maybe what you needed to do is to realize, I need to get out of here.
Uh-huh.
There's a wonderful saying that says, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So we really learn from our experience. We learn from our follies.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is it possible to hold at the same time the unpleasant and the pleasant, to have an experience where they're both happening at the same time, or would you consider an impossibility and one is just very, very quickly coming upon the heels of the other? Like, for instance, today, I was at work, in the bathroom, and I flushed the toilet, and it just exploded on me. The water just started coming in. And so, but I was fascinated that it did that, and that was pleasant. But it was scary. I didn't want to get all wet and stuff, so that part was kind of unpleasant.
And it was a very hot day, and the fact that it's cool water was kind of, it was very refreshing. It was also very pleasant. And the only thing that was unpleasant was what lended itself to the sense of unpleasantness was all the judgments of what it is. It's like someone, you know, it's like, I mean, they think of pleasant, unpleasant, it gets, the theory Buddhist theory behind this is that we're trying to discern what the experience is like prior to any evaluation or judgment in and of itself. So, for example, if you say you're walking around barefoot in the dark outside, and you know you step in something that's really soft and kind of wet, and actually, you know, initially it feels kind of cool and refreshing, kind of smooshy, kind of nice. Oh, and it reminds you of a kid kind of playing in the sandbox in the mud and squishing the mud through your toes. It was kind of fun and nice. And then it dawns on you that, well, you know, my neighbor has a dog. And then suddenly something, all this aversion and anger and all this reaction about, you know, probably that's what you stepped in, is dog poop. So then you turn on the outside light and you look down, and in fact that's what it is. It's not dog poop, but it's some mud, just like when you were a kid. And I say, oh great, and you go back, take you back again, you stomp in it some more and feel the mud going through your toes. See, the mind's judgment and reactions can have a lot to do with how we take something to be pleasant and unpleasant. The theory behind this Buddhist category is that there's the raw building block initially, prior to the judgments, is what, you know, we're trying to be sensitive to. So, you know, something as complicated as a toilet flushing, you know, backing up or whatever, there's all these layers and layers of reactions to that that feed into when we say it's pleasant or unpleasant. But in the rawness of the experience, the immediacy of it, what is it? Maybe, you know. But can't something be both pleasant and unpleasant? I think in a lot of things can be, because a lot of things are complicated, many things happening at once as part of it. The Buddhist theory of cognition, perception, is that you can only have, there's only one moment of perception at a time that are happening very, very quickly. So any given moment of perception is either one of these three categories. But the way the mind kind of looks at the situation, we don't see the kind of details of the moment-to-moment experience, but rather we kind of often kind of relate to all the whole shebang at once. Yes?
Well, to make a bad joke, having eaten too much for dinner this evening, at the start of the sitting, I was trying to focus on my breath, and at some point I became aware of it, that I was being interfered with focusing on my breath because my belly was hurt. So I focused on my belly for a while, and then it went away. And then I was more able to focus on the breath, which seemed, in context to that, is sort of the benefit to do. But I don't see how that relates to what you said about whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. It was unpleasant, but it didn't seem like I had a lot of judgment.
Great, you're free. No problem. I mean, what you described is a perfect example of mindfulness. You stay with the breath, something else was more predominant, maybe the fullness in your belly, maybe it was unpleasant. You hung out there for a while until it passed, and then you went back to your breathing. That's beautiful. But it's also possible that your person reacts to that.
Okay.
And you didn't react, so count yourself lucky. or wise. Yes?
I've been working on trying to connect with the physical sensations, to take the judgment out of it, to let my body sensations speak to me.
Great.
And, you know, just kind of honor them. And it sounds like that's kind of synonymous to what you're saying.
Yeah, it's closely, pretty similar. To have many of us don't live in the direct experience of what's happening in our life. We live we don't even live in our perceptions of what's happening. We live on, you know, all the associated thoughts connected to it. And those associated thoughts can be many generations removed from the, you know, the directness of what's happening.
Sort of in the context of mindfulness,
sounds like, that sounds great. Yeah. So in the immediacy of this experience, is it a pleasant or unpleasant or neutral experience? And based on that, seeing that, can I see then how I'm relating to it? Is there reactivity to it? And then is there a choice that's different than the reactive ways? That seems like a very nice way. As the mind gets stiller and more concentrated, it doesn't have to be so thoughtful, that process. It's almost automatic. It's more like when you see something so clearly, you see this process so clearly, it stands out. It's not a matter of trying to see it. It's happening anyway. And it's highlighted. It's like, then the letting go is almost automatic. Yes?
Along with what you were saying, once you get to that idea that you have a choice, no matter,
yeah.
How do you break out of then patterns that you might have, negative patterns that you might have when you react to something that's unpleasant?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a little bit hard to say because if the mindfulness has done its work and you really, really see where the point of choice is, then you choose. It's really easy.
Sometimes you might know the right choice, but it's difficult to actually act.
Then you haven't seen the place of choice yet. You haven't gone close enough to it. You haven't seen it clearly enough. Mm-hmm. And then there's a kind of idea that you've seen, oh, you kind of generally, I kind of see, yeah, it's a good idea, or I see that I need to do this, as opposed to the moment workings of the mind, the actual place of where the choice is. So, in other words, what's needed is the greater mindfulness.
Greater
mindfulness, looking more carefully, looking more, greater detail, what's actually going on here. Rather than some abstract idea of what I need to do, you need to go in and actually see more clearly what's actually happening in your direct experience. Mm-hmm. And then you might find the place where the choice is easy. And then let go. So that's kind of one response. Letting go is not easy, or choosing wisely is not easy. And so the Buddhist tradition has a lot of supporting practices to support both the development of mindfulness, but also support for helping us live a wise, choose a wise life. And so the Eightfold Path, for example, has a lot of different elements besides mindfulness that helps us in being able to do that. So, for example, if you don't live an ethical life, it might be much harder to find that place of choice. So it's important to live an ethical life and practice right speech. If you don't have developed some very good understanding of the principles of the practice, then it might also be harder to find a place of choice and get settled. Yes.
A place, a kind of thing that gets in the way for me with this is wanting to hurt people. And especially when it comes to relationships with people, anything that comes in as unpleasant to me has the potential to be an emergency. I'm in a car and I'm driving and they say something sharply, I'm afraid I might get in an accident. Or whether they're just frustrated, but I have a machine in me that says, if I don't fix this immediately, they might walk out of my life forever. So if anything is an emergency, I tell myself, so I need to do something fast, and so that sort of means react as opposed to this deliberate response. Now, after maybe even a second, I probably know what is the case and whether it's an emergency, but it's tough for me to get off that track. So I go from, oh, they're not telling me I'm going to hit something, they're telling me my blinker's on. Okay, now I need to fix this. I need to either show why they were wrong or why it was okay or excuse it. And it's tough for me to get onto the response track.
Great. What I suspect is that there's a predisposition operating and that you need to discover and come to terms with that predisposition which is operating before this is an emergency arises. And probably that predisposition, the kind of underlying attitude, which is always there, is probably fear. So what you need to do then is to bring your attention to fear and get to know that better, and resolve it. It's resolvable. And then when you're no longer carrying an attitude of fear around, then you might you're not going to automatically trigger the idea this is an emergency every time something's unpleasant.
What do you mean it's resolvable? Fear is resolvable.
Well, not all fears, but when a person has an underlying attitude of fear that goes with them everywhere in their life, that's optional. Well, that doesn't feel optional to the person, but that's something that's constructed. It's an assumption that's maybe deeply rooted in the psyche, but it doesn't have to be there. And it's possible to bring mindfulness to that fear, bring mindfulness to the underlying conditions there, and have those be released so that we're no longer walking around with a constant attitude of fear that pervades everything that we encounter.
And that's just meditation. Doing a lot of meditation will somehow undermine that eventually.
For some people, it might. For some people, meditation is not enough. For some people, they need to do therapy or do other things. Fear can have a deep hold on us, and sometimes it's not some. For some people, it's not enough to do meditation or practice mindfulness. So mindfulness can be quite powerful. Oh. So is that enough? So let's sit for a few minutes.